He offered me the flashlight. I shook my head. Use it to spot me. You don't get it. You don't need it for light. You need it for her. For a minute, I still didn't get it. Unscrew the lens cap. Take out the batteries. Put her inside. I'll hand you down the water. Wireman laughed without humor. Wireman likes it, Nino. Then he bent to me. Now go on. Bitch or birch, drown her and let's have done with her. 9. The fourth rung snapped. The ladder tilted and I fell off, with the flashlight still clamped between my side and my stump, first shining up at the darkening sky, then illuminating lumps of coral coated with moss. My head connected with one of these, and I saw stars. A moment later, I was lying on a jagged bed of bones and staring into Adriana Eastlake Paulson's eternal grin. One of those pallid toads leaped at me from between her mossy teeth, and I batted at it with the barrel of the flashlight. Muchacho! Wireman shouted, and Jack added, Boss, are you all right? I was bleeding from the scalp. I could feel it running down my face in warm streams, but I thought I was okay. Certainly I had been through worse in the Land of a Thousand Lakes. And the ladder, although aslant, was still standing. I looked to my right, and there was the moss-covered table whiskey keg we'd come all this way to find. There were two toads on it now, instead of one. They saw me looking and leaped into my face, eyes bulging, mouths gaping. I had no doubt that Percy wished they had teeth, like Elizabeth Big Boy. Ah, the good old days. I'm okay, I said, batting the toads away and struggling to sit up. Bones broke beneath me and all around me. Except no, they didn't break. They were too old and damp to break. They first bent, then popped. Send down the water. It's okay to drop it in the bag, just try not to hit me in the head with it. I looked at Nan Melda. I'm going to take your silver bracelets, I told her. But it's not stealing. If you're somewhere close and can see what I'm doing, I hope you'll think of it as sharing, kind of passing on. I slipped them off her remains and put them on my own left wrist, raising my arm and letting gravity slide them up to the catch point. Above me, Jack was hanging head down into the cistern. Watch out, Edgar. The bag came down. One of the bones I'd broken in my fall punched through the plastic, and water came trickling out. I yelled in fright and anger, opened the bag, looked inside. Only a single plastic bottle had been punctured. The other two were still whole. I turned to the moss-covered ceramic keg, slipped my hand into the thicket of slime under it, and worked it free. It didn't want to come, but the thing inside had taken my daughter, and I meant to have it. Finally, it rolled toward me, and when it did, a good-sized chunk of coral slipped away from the other side of it and thudded to the muddy bottom of the cistern. I shone the light on the keg. There was only a thin scum of moss on the side that had been facing the wall, and I could see the Highlander in his kilt, one foot raised behind him as he did his fling. I could also see a jagged crack running straight down the keg's curved side. That chunk of coral had made it when it fell out of the wall. The keg, which Libet had filled from the swimming pool back in 1927, had been leaking ever since that chunk had struck it, and now it was almost dry. I could hear something rattling inside. I'll kill you if you don't stop, but if you do, I'll let you go, you and your friends. I felt my lips skin back in a grin. And had Pam seen a grin like that when my hand closed around her neck? Of course she had. You shouldn't have killed my daughter. Stop now, or I'll take the other one, too. Wireman called down, and the desperation in his voice was naked. Venus just popped, amigo. I take that as a bad sign. I was sitting against one damp wall, with coral poking into my back and bones poking into my side. Movement was restricted, and in some other country my hip was throbbing badly, not screaming yet, but probably soon. I had no idea how I was supposed to climb the ladder again in such condition, but I was too angry to worry about it. Pardon me, Miss Cookie, I murmured to Addie and stuck the butt of the flashlight in her bony mouth. Then I took the ceramic keg in both hands, because both hands were there. I bent my good leg, pushing bones and muck to either side with the heel of my boot, lifted the keg into the dusty beam of light and brought it down on my upraised knee. It cracked again, releasing a little flood of sludgy water, but didn't break. Percy screamed inside it, and I felt my nose begin to bleed. And the light from the flash changed. It turned red. In that scarlet glow, the skulls of Addie Paulson and Nan Melda gaped and grinned at me. I looked at the moss-covered walls of this filthy throat into which I'd climbed of my own free will and saw other faces. Pam's. Mary Ayers, twisted in rage as she brought the butt of her gun down on Ilse's head. Cayman's, filled with terminal surprise as he dropped with his thunderclap heart attack. Tom, twisting the wheel of his car to send it hurtling into concrete at 70 miles an hour. Worst of all, I saw Monica Goldstein screaming, "You killed my doggy." "Edgar, what's happening?" That was Jack, 1,000 miles away. I thought of Shark Puppy on the Bone, singing Dig. I thought of telling Tom, "That man died in his pickup." "Then put me in your pocket and we'll go together," she said. "We'll sail together into your real other life, and all the cities of the world will be at your feet. You'll live long. I can arrange that. And you'll be the artist of the age. They'll rank you with Goya, with Leonardo." "Edgar?" There was panic in Wireman's voice. "People are coming from the beachside. I think I hear them. This is bad, muchacho." "You don't need them. We don't need them. They're nothing but crew." "Nothing but crew." At that, the red rage descended over my mind, even as my right hand began to slip out of existence again. But before it could go completely, before I lost my grip on either my fury or the damned cracked keg. "Stick it up your friend, you dumb birch," I said, and raised the keg over my throbbing, upthrust knee again. "Stick it in the buddy." I brought it down as hard as I could on that bony knob. There was a pain, but less than I had been prepared for. And in the end, that's usually the way, don't you think? "Stick it up, you fucking chum." The keg didn't break. Already cracked, it simply burst, showering my jeans with murky wetness from the inch or so of water that had still been left inside. And a small china figure tumbled out. A woman, wrapped in a cloak and a hood. The hand clasping the edges of the cloak together at her neck was not really a hand at all, but a claw. I snatched the thing up. I had no time to study it. They were coming now. I had no doubt of that. Coming for Wireman and Jack. But there was long enough to see that Percy was extraordinarily beautiful. If that was, you could ignore the claw hand and the disquieting hint of a third eye beneath the hair that had tumbled out from beneath her hood and over her brow. The thing was also extremely delicate, almost translucent. Except when I tried to snap it between my hands, it was like trying to snap steel. "Edgar!" Jack screamed. "Keep them back," I snapped. "You have to keep them back." I tucked her into the breast pocket of my shirt and immediately felt the sickening warmth begin to spread through to my skin. And it was thrumming. My untrustworthy mojo arm was gone again, so I stuck a bottle of Evian water between my side and my stump, then spun off the cap. I repeated this clumsy and time-consuming process with the other bottle. From overhead, Wireman cried out in a voice that was almost steady, "Stay back! This is tipped with silver. I'll use it." The response to this was clear, even at the bottom of the cistern. "Do you think you could reload fast enough to shoot all three of us?" "No, Emery," Wireman responded. He spoke as if to a child, and his voice had firmed all the way. I never loved him so much as I did then. "I'll settle for you." Now came the hard part, the terrible part. I began unscrewing the cap of the flashlight. On the second turn, the light went out, and I was in nearly perfect darkness. I dumped the D batteries from the flashlight's steel sleeve, then fumbled for the first bottle of Evian. My fingers closed on it, and I poured it in, working by feel. I had no idea how much the flashlight would hold, and I thought one bottle would fill it all the way to the top. I was wrong. I was reaching for the second one when full night must have come to Duma Key. I say that because that was when the china figure in my pocket came to life. 10. Anytime I doubt that last mad passage in the cistern, all I have to do is look at the traffic jam of white scars on the left side of my chest. Anyone seeing me naked wouldn't notice them particularly. Because of my accident, I am a road map of scars, and that small white bundle tends to get lost among the gaudier ones. But these were made by the teeth of a living doll, one that chewed through my shirt and skin and into the muscle beneath, one that meant to chew all the way to my heart. 11. I almost knocked the second bottle of water over before managing to pick it up. That was mostly from surprise, but there was plenty of pain as well, and I cried out. I felt fresh blood begin to flow, this time running down inside my shirt to the crease between my torso and my belly. She was twisting in my pocket, writhing in my pocket, her teeth sinking in and biting and plowing, digging deeper, deeper. I had to tear her out, and I ripped away a good chunk of bloody shirt and flesh with her. The figure had lost that smooth, cool feel. It was hot now, and writhing in my hand. "Come on!" Wireman yelled from up above. "Come on, you want it?" She sank her tiny china teeth, sharp as needles, into the webbing of flesh between my thumb and first finger. I howled. She might have gotten away then, in spite of all my fury and determination, but Nan Melda's bracelets slid down, and I could feel her cringing away from them, deeper into my palm. One leg actually slithered out between my second finger and my ring finger. I squeezed all my fingers together, pinning it, pinning her. Her movements grew sluggish. I can't swear that one of the bracelets was touching her. It was pitch black, but I'm almost positive it was. From above me came the hollow, compressed air, "Chow!" of the harpoon pistol, and then a scream that seemed to rip through my brains. Below it, behind it, I could hear Wireman shouting, "Get in back of me, Jack! Take one of the—" Then no more, just the sound of grunting cries from my friends and the angry, unearthly laughter of two long-dead children. I had the flashlight's barrel clasped between my knees, and I didn't need anyone to tell me that anything could go wrong in the dark, especially for a one-armed man. I would only have one chance. Under conditions like that, it's best not to hesitate.
"No! Stop! Don't do the—"
I dropped her in. And one result was immediate. Above me, the children's angry laughter turned to shrieks of surprised horror. Then I heard Jack. He sounded hysterical and half insane, but I was never so glad to hear anyone in my life.
"That's right, go on and run, before your fucking ship sails and leaves you behind."
Now I had a delicate problem. I had taken hold of the flashlight in my remaining hand, and she was inside, but the cap was somewhere in here with me, and I couldn't see it. Nor did I have another hand to feel around with.
"Wireman," I called. "Wireman, are you there?"
After a moment long enough to first seed four kinds of fear and then start them growing, he answered.
"Yeah, muchacho, still here." "All right. One of them scratched me, and it ought to be disinfected, but otherwise, yeah, basically I think we both are."
"Jack, can you come down here? I need a hand." And then sitting there crooked among the bones with the water-filled shell of the flashlight held up like the Statue of Liberty's torch, I began to laugh. Some things are just so true you have to. 12. My eyes had adjusted enough for me to make out a dark shape seeming to float down from the side of the cistern, Jack descending the ladder. The sleeve of the flashlight was thrumming in my hand, weak but definitely thrumming. I pictured a woman drowning in a narrow steel tank and pushed the image away. It was too much like what happened to Ilsa, and the monster I had imprisoned was nothing like Ilsa. "There's a rung missing," I said. "If you don't want to die down here, you want to be careful as hell." "I can't die tonight," he said in a thin and shaking voice I never would have identified as his. "I have a date tomorrow."
"Congratulations."
"Thank you." He missed the rung. The ladder shifted. For a moment I was sure he was going to come down on top of me, on top of the upheld flashlight. The water would spill out, she would spill out, and it all would have been for nothing.
"What's happening?" Wireman shouted from above us. "What the fuck's happening?"
Jack settled back against the wall, one hand gripping a lucky chunk of coral that he happened to find at the last crucial second. I could see one of his legs plunge down like a piston to the next intact rung, and there was a healthy ripping sound.
"Man," he whispered. Man, oh fucking man." "What's happening?"
Wireman nearly roared.
"Jack Cantori ripped out the seat of his pants," I said. "Now shut up a minute."
"Jack, you're almost there. She's in the flashlight, but I've only got one hand and I can't pick up the cap. You have to come down and find it. I don't care if you step on me, just don't bump the flashlight, okay?"
"Oh, okay. Jesus, Edgar, I thought I was going to go ass over teapot."
"So did I. Come down now, but slowly." He came down, first stepping on my thigh. It hurt. And then putting his foot on one of the empty Evian bottles. It crackled. Then he stepped on something that broke with a damp pop, like a defective noisemaker. Edgar, what was that? He sounded on the verge of tears.
What?
Nothing. I was pretty sure it had been Addie's skull. His hip thumped the flashlight. Cold water slopped over my wrist. Inside the metal sleeve, something bumped and turned. Inside my head, a terrible black-green eye, the color of water at the depth just before all light fails, also turned. It looked at my most secret thoughts, at the place where anger surpasses rage and becomes homicide. It saw, then bit down, the way a woman would bite into a plum. I will never forget the sensation. Watch it, Jack, close quarters, like a midget submarine. Careful as you can. I'm freaking out, boss. Little touch of claustrophobia. Take a deep breath. You can do this. We'll be out soon. Do you have matches? He didn't, nor a lighter. Jack might not be averse to 6 beers on a Saturday night, but his lungs were smoke-free. Thus there ensued a long, nightmarish space of minutes. Wireman says no more than 4, but to me it seemed 30, 30 at least, during which Jack knelt, felt among the bones, stood, moved a little, knelt again, felt again. My arm was getting tired. My hand was going numb. Blood continued to run from the wounds on my chest, either because they were slow and clotting or because they weren't clotting at all. But my hand was the worst. All feeling was leaving it. And soon I began to believe I was no longer holding the flashlight sleeve at all, because I couldn't see it, and I was losing the sense of it against my skin. The feeling of weight in my hand had been swallowed by the tired throb of my muscles. I had to fight the urge to wrap the metal sleeve against the side of the cistern to make sure I still had it, even though I knew if I did I might drop it. I began to think that the cap must be lost in the maze of bones and bone fragments, and Jack would never find it without a light.
"What's happening?" Wireman called.
"Getting there," I called back. Blood dribbled into my left eye, stinging, and I blinked it away. I tried to think of Illy, my if-so girl, and was horrified to realize I couldn't remember her face.
"Little Slag, little Horrock, we're working it out."
"What?"
"Snag. Little Snag, little hold-up. You fucking deaf, Wehrman?"
Was the flashlight sleeve tilting? I feared it was. Water could be running over my hand and I might now be too numb to feel it. But if the sleeve wasn't tilting, and I tried to correct it, I'd make matters worse. If water's running out, her head will be above the surface again in a matter of seconds, and then it'll be all over. You know that, right? I knew. I sat in the dark with my arm up, afraid to do anything, bleeding and waiting. Time had been canceled and memory was a ghost.
"Here it is," Jack said at last.
"It's caught in someone's ribs."
"Wait."
"Got it." "Thank God," I said. "Thank Christ." I could see him in front of me, a dim shape with one knee between my awkwardly bent legs, planted in the litter of disarranged bones that had once been part of John Eastlake's eldest daughter. I held the flashlight sleeve out. "Screw it on. Gently does it because I can't hold it straight much longer." "Luckily," he said, "I have 2 hands. And he put one of his over mine, steadying the water-filled flashlight as he began screwing the cap back on. He paused only once to ask me why I was crying.
"Relief,"
I said. "Go on, finish. Hurry."
When it was done, I took the capped flashlight from him. It wasn't as heavy as when it had been filled with D-cells, but I didn't care about that. What I cared about was making sure the lid was screwed down tight. It seemed to be. I told Jack to have Wireman check it again when he got back up.
"Will do," he said. "And try not to break any more rungs. I'm going to need them all."
"You get past the broken one, Edgar, and we'll haul you the rest of the way."
"Okay. And I won't tell anyone you tore out the seat of your pants." At that, he actually laughed. I watched the dark shape of him go up the ladder, taking a big stride to get past the broken rung. I had a moment of doubt, accompanied by a terrible vision of tiny china hands unscrewing the flashlight cap from inside. Yes, even though I was sure the fresh water had immobilized her. But Jack didn't cry out or come tumbling back down, and the bad moment passed. There was a circle of brighter darkness above my head, and eventually he reached it. When he was up and out, Wireman called down,
"Now you, muchacho."
"In a minute," I said.
"Are your girlfriends gone?"
"Ran away.
Shore leave over, I guess."
"And Emery?"
"That you need to see for yourself, I think. Come on up."
I repeated, "In a minute." I leaned my head back against the moss-slimy coral, closed my eyes, and reached out. I kept reaching until I touched something smooth and round. Then my first two fingers slipped into an indentation that was almost certainly an eye socket. And since I was sure it had been Adriana's skull, Jack had crushed. All's ending as well as can be, at this end of the island, I told Nan Melda. And this isn't much of a grave, but you may not be in much longer, my dear. May I keep your bracelets? There might be more to do. Yes, I was afraid I had another thing coming.
Edgar?
Wireman sounded worried. Who are you talking to?
The one who really stopped her, I said.
And because the one who really stopped her did not tell me she would have her bracelets back, I kept them on and began the slow and painful work of getting to my feet. Dislodged bone fragments and bits of moss-encrusted ceramic showered down around my feet. My left knee, my good one, felt swollen and tight against the torn cloth of my pants. My head was throbbing and my chest was on fire. The ladder looked at least a mile high, but I could see the dark shapes of Jack and Wireman hanging over the rim of the cistern, waiting to grab me when, if, I managed to haul myself into grabbing range. I thought, there's a three-quarter moon tonight, and I can't see it until I get out of this hole in the ground. So I got started. 13. The moon had risen fat and yellow above the eastern horizon, casting its glow on the lush jungle growth that overbore the south end of the quay and gilding the east side of John Eastlake's ruined mansion, where he had once lived with his housekeeper and his six girls, happily enough, I suppose, before Libet's tumble from the pony trap changed things. It also gilded the ancient coral-encrusted skeleton that lay on the mattress of trampled vines Jack and Wireman had uprooted to free the cistern cap. Looking at Emery Paulson's remains, a snatch of Shakespeare from my high school days recurred, and I spoke it aloud. "Full fathom five thy father lies. Those are pearls that were his eyes." Jack shivered violently as if stroked by a keen, wet wind. He actually clutched himself. This time he got it. Wireman bent and picked up one thin, trailing arm, but snapped in three without a sound. Emery Paulson had been in the Caldo a long, long time. There was a harpoon sticking through the shelly harp of his ribs. Wireman retrieved it now, having to work the tip free of the ground in order to take it back. "How'd you keep the twins from hell off you with the spear pistol unloaded?" I asked. Wireman jabbed the harpoon in his hand like a dagger. Jack nodded. "Yeah." I grabbed one out of his belt and did the same. I don't know how long it would have worked over the long haul, though. They were like mad dogs. Wireman replaced the silver tip harpoon he'd used on Emery in his belt. "Speaking of the long haul, we might consider another storage container for your new doll. What do you think, Edgar?" He was right. Somehow I couldn't imagine Percy spending the next 80 years in the barrel of a Garrity flashlight. I was already wondering how thin the shield between the battery case and the lens housing might be. And the rock that had fallen out of the cistern wall and cracked the table whiskey keg, had that been an accident? Or a final victory of mind over matter after years of patient work? Percy's version of digging through the wall of her cell with a sharpened spoon handle. Still, the flashlight had served its purpose. God bless Jack Cantori's practical mind. No, that was too chintzy. God bless Jack. "There's a custom silversmith in Sarasota," Wireman said. "Mexicano, muy talentoso. Miss Eastlake had a few pieces of his stuff. I bet I could commission him to make a watertight tube big enough to hold the flashlight. That'd give us what insurance companies and football coaches call double coverage. It'd be pricey, but so what? Barring probate snags, I'm going to be an extremely wealthy man. Caught a break there, muchacho."
"La lotería," I said without thinking.
"Sí," he said. "La goddamn lotería. Come on, Jack, help me tip Emery into the cistern." Jack grimaced. "Okay, but I really don't want to touch it."
"I'll help with Emery," I said. "You hold on to the flashlight. Wireman, let's do this." The two of us rolled Emery into the hole, then threw in the pieces of him that broke off, or as many as we could find.
I still remember his stony coral grin as he tumbled into the dark to join his bride. And sometimes, of course, I dream about it. In these dreams I hear Addie and Em calling up to me from the dark, asking me if I wouldn't like to come down and join them. And sometimes in those dreams I do. Sometimes I throw myself into that dark and stinking throat just to make an end to my memories. These are the dreams from which I wake up screaming, thrashing at the dark with the hand that is no longer there. 14. Wireman and Jack slid the cap into position again, and then we went back to Elizabeth's Mercedes. That was a slow, painful walk, and by the end of it, I really wasn't walking at all, I was lurching. It was as if the clock had been rolled back to the previous October. I was already thinking of the few OxyContin tablets I had waiting for me back at Big Pink. I would have 3, I decided. 3 would do more than kill the pain. With luck, they would also pound me into at least a few hours of sleep. Both of my friends asked if I didn't want to sling an arm around them. I refused. This wasn't going to be my last walk tonight. I had made up my mind about that. I still didn't have the last piece of the puzzle, but I had an idea. What had Elizabeth told Wireman? You will want to, but you mustn't. Too late, too late, too late. The idea wasn't clear. What was clear was the sound of the shells. You could hear that sound from anywhere inside Big Pink. But to get the full effect, you really had to come up on the place from outside. That was when they sounded the most like voices. So many nights I had wasted painting when I could have been listening. Tonight, I would listen. Outside the pillars, Wireman paused. Abyssus abyssum invocat, he said. Hell invokes hell, Jack said and sighed. Wireman looked at me. Think we'll have any trouble negotiating the road home? Now? No. And are we done here? We are. Will we ever come again? No, I said. I looked at the ruined house, dreaming in the moonlight. Its secrets were out. I realized we'd left little Libet's heart-shaped box behind, but maybe that was for the best. Let it stay here. No one will come here anymore. Jack looked at me curious and a little afraid. How can you know that? I know, I said. 21. The Shells by Moonlight. 1. We had no trouble negotiating the road home. The smell was still there, but it was better now. Partly because a good wind was getting up, blowing in off the gulf, and partly because it was just better now. The courtyard lights of El Palacio were on a timer, and they looked wonderful, twinkling out of the dark. Inside the house, Wireman went methodically from room to room, turning on more lights, turning on all the lights, until the house where Elizabeth had spent most of her life glowed like an ocean liner coming into port at midnight. When El Palacio was lit to the max, we took turns in the shower, passing the water-filled flashlight from hand to hand like a baton as we did so. Someone was always holding it. Wireman went first, then Jack, then me. After showering, each of us was inspected by the other two, then scrubbed with hydrogen peroxide where any skin was broken. I was the worst, and when I finally put my clothes back on, I stung all over. I was finishing with my boots, laboriously tying them one-handed, when Wireman came into the guest bedroom looking grave. There's a message you need to hear on the machine downstairs. From the Tampa police. Here, let me help you. He went down on one knee before me and began tightening my laces. I saw, without surprise, that the gray in his hair had advanced, and suddenly a bolt of alarm went through me. I reached out and grabbed his meaty shoulder. The flashlight, does Jack... Relax. He's sitting in Miss Eastlake's old china parlor, and he's got it on his lap. I hurried, nevertheless. I don't know what I expected to find, the room empty, the unscrewed flashlight lying on the rug in a puddle of dampness, maybe, or Jack sex-changed into the three-eyed, claw-handed bitch that had come falling out of the old cracked keg. But he was only sitting there with the flashlight, looking troubled. I asked if he was all right, and I took a good look at his eyes. If he was going wrong, I thought I'd see it in his eyes. I'm fine, but that message from the cop. He shook his head.
Well, let's hear it.
A man identifying himself as Detective Sampson said that he was trying to reach both Edgar Freemantle and Jerome Wireman to ask some questions about Mary Iyer. He particularly wanted to speak to Mr. Freemantle if he had not left for Rhode Island or Minnesota, where Sampson understood the body of his daughter was being transported for burial.
I'm sure Mr. Freemantle is in a state of bereavement, Sampson said, and I'm sure these are really Providence PD's questions, but we know Mr. Freemantle did a newspaper interview with the Iyer woman recently, and I volunteered to talk with him and yourself, Mr. Wireman, if possible. I can tell you over the phone what Providence is most curious about, if this message tape doesn't run out.
It didn't. And the last piece fell into place. 2.
Edgar, this is crazy, Jack said.
It was the third time he'd said it, and he was beginning to sound desperate.
Totally nuts.
He turned to Wireman.
You tell him. Un poco loco,
Wireman agreed, but I knew the difference between poco and muy, even if Jack didn't. We were standing in the courtyard, between Jack's sedan and Elizabeth's old Mercedes. The moon had risen higher, so had the wind. The surf was pounding the shore, and a mile away, the shells under Big Pink would be discussing all sorts of strange things. Muy asustador.
But I think I could talk all night and still not change his mind.
Because you know I'm right, I said.
Tu perdón, amigo. You might be right, he said. I'll tell you one thing. Wireman intends to get down on his fat and aging knees and pray you are.
Jack looked at the flashlight in my hand.
At least don't take that, he said. Excuse my French, boss, but you're fucking crazy to take that.
I know what I'm doing, I said, hoping to God it was true. And stay here, both of you. Don't try to follow me. I raised the flashlight and pointed it at Wireman. You're on your honor.
All right, Edgar. My honor's a tattered thing, but I swear on it. One practical question. Are you sure 2 Tylenol will be enough to get you down the beach to your house on your feet? Or are you going to wind up doing the crawly gator?
I'll get there upright.
And you'll call when you do.
I'll call. He opened his arms then, and I stepped into them. He kissed me on both cheeks.
I love you, Edgar, he said. You're a hell of a man. Sano como una manzana.
What does that one mean?
He shrugged. Stay healthy, I think.
Jack offered his hand, the left one. The boy was a learner, and then decided a hug was in order after all. In my ear, he whispered, give me the flashlight, boss. In his, I whispered back, can't. Sorry.
I started along the path to the back of the house, the one that would take me to the boardwalk. At the end of that boardwalk, 1,000 or so years ago, I'd met the big man I was now leaving behind. He'd been sitting under a striped umbrella. He had offered me iced green tea, very cooling. And he had said, so, the limping stranger arriveth at last. And now he goeth, I thought. I turned back. They were watching me. Muchacho, Wireman called. I thought he was going to ask me to come back so we could think about this a little more, talk it over a little more. But I had underestimated him. Vaya con Dios, mi hombre. I gave him a final wave and walked around the corner of the house.
3. So then I took my last great beach walk, as limping and painful as my first ones along that shell-littered shore. Only those had been by the rosy light of early morning, when the world was at its most still. The only things moving, the mild lap of waves and the brown clouds of peeps that fled before me. This was different. Tonight the wind roared and the waves raged, not alighting on the shore but committing suicide on it. The rollers further out were painted chrome, and several times I thought I saw the Percy from the corner of my eye, but each time I turned to look, there was nothing. Tonight there was nothing on my part of the gulf but moonlight. I lurched along, flashlight gripped in my hand, thinking of the day I had walked here with Ilsa. She had asked me if this was the most beautiful place on earth, and I had assured her that no, there were at least 3 others that were more beautiful. But I couldn't remember what I'd told her those others were, only that they were hard to spell. What I remembered most clearly was her saying I deserved a beautiful place, and time to rest, time to heal. Tears started to come then, and I let them. I had the flashlight in the hand I could have used to wipe them away, so I just let them come. 4. I heard Big Pink before I actually saw it. The shells under the house had never been so loud. I walked a little farther, then stopped. It was just ahead of me now, a black shape where the stars were blotted out. Another 40 or 50 slow, limping paces, and moonlight began to fill in the details. All the lights were out, even the ones I almost always left on in the kitchen and Florida room. That could have been a power outage caused by the wind, but I didn't think that was it. I realized the shells were talking in a voice I recognized. I should have. It was my own. Had I always known that? I suppose I had. On some level, unless we're mad, I think most of us know the various voices of our own imaginations. And our memories, of course. They have voices, too. Ask anyone who has ever lost a limb or a child, or a long-cherished dream. Ask anyone who blames himself for a bad decision, usually made in a raw instant, an instant that is most commonly red. Our memories have voices, too. Often sad ones that clamor like raised arms in the dark. I walked on, leaving tracks behind me that featured one dragging foot. The blacked-out hulk of Big Pink grew closer. It wasn't ruined like Heron's Roost, but tonight, it was haunted. Tonight there was a ghost waiting. Or maybe something a little more solid. The wind gusted and I looked left, into its pushing force. The ship was out there now, all right. Lightless and silent, its sails so many flapping rags in the wind, waiting. Might as well go, the shell said as I stood in the moonlight, now less than 20 yards from my house. Wipe the blackboard clean. It can be done. No one knows it better than you. And just sail away. Leave the sadness behind. If you want to play, you gotta pay. And the best part? The best part is I don't have to go alone, I said. The wind gusted, the shells murmured. And from the blackness under the house, where that bony bed lay 6 feet deep, a dark shadow slipped free and stepped into the moonlight. It stood bent over for a moment, as if considering, and then began to come toward me. She began to come toward me. But not Percy. Percy had been drowned to sleep. Ilsa. 5. She didn't walk. I didn't expect her to walk. She shambled. It was a miracle, a black one, that she could move at all. After that last phone call with Pam, you couldn't call it a conversation exactly. I'd gone out Big Pink's back door and snapped the handle off the broom I used to sweep sand from the walk leading to the mailbox. Then I'd gone around to the beach, down to where the sand was wet and shining. I hadn't remembered what came after that, because I didn't want to, obviously. Only now I did, now I had to. Because now my handiwork was standing in front of me. It was Ilsa, yet not Ilsa. Her face was there, then it blurred and it wasn't. Her form was there, then it slipped toward shapelessness before firming up again. Little pieces of dead sea oats and bits of shell dropped from her cheeks and chest and hips and legs as she moved. The moonlight picked out an eye that was heartbreakingly clear, heartbreakingly hers, and then it was gone, only to reappear again, shining in the moonlight. The Ilsa shambling toward me was made of sand. "Daddy," she said. Her voice was dry, with a grating undertone. As if there were shells caught in there somewhere. I suppose there were. You will want to, but you mustn't, Elizabeth had said. But sometimes we can't help ourselves. The sand girl held out her arm. The wind gusted and the fingers at the end of the hand blurred as fine grains blew off them and thinned them to bones. More sand skirled up from around her and the hand fattened again. Her features shifted like a landscape under rapidly passing summer clouds. It was fascinating. Hypnotic. Give me the flashlight, she said. Then we'll go on board together. On the ship, I can be the way you remember me. Or you don't have to remember anything. The waves were on the march. Under the stars, they roared in one after the other. Under the moon, under Big Pink. The shell spoke loudly, my voice arguing with itself. Bring the buddy, I win. Sit in the chum, you win. Here in front of me stood Ilsa made of sand, a shifting houri by the light of a three-quarter moon. Her features never the same from one second to the next. Now she was Iliad 9. Now she was Iliad 15, headed out on her first real date. Now she was Illy as she'd looked getting off the plane in December. Illy the college girl with an engagement ring on her finger. Here stood the one I'd always loved the best. Wasn't that why Percy had killed her? With her hand held out for the flashlight. The flashlight was my boarding pass for a long cruise on forgetful seas. Of course, that part might be a lie. But sometimes we have to take a chance, and usually we do. As Wireman says, we fool ourselves so much we could do it for a living. Mary brought salt with her, I said. Bags and bags of salt. She put it in the tub. The police want to know why. But they'd never believe the truth, would they? She stood before me with the thundering incoming waves behind her. She stood there blowing away and reforming from the sand beneath her, around her. She stood there and said nothing, only holding her arm outstretched to take what she had come for. Drawing you in the sand wasn't enough. Even Mary drowning you wasn't enough. She had to drown you in salt water. I glanced down at the flashlight. Percy told her just what to do, from my picture. Give it to me, Daddy, the shifting sand girl said. Her hand was still held out. Only with the wind blowing, sometimes it was a claw. Even with sand feeding up from the beach to keep it plump, sometimes it was a claw. Give it to me and we can go. I sighed. Some things were inevitable, after all. All right. I took a step toward her. Another of Wireman's sayings occurred to me. In the end, we wear out our worries. All right, Miss Cookie, but it'll cost you. Cost me what? Her voice was the sound of sand against a window, the grating sound of the shells, but it was also Ilsa's voice, my if-so girl. Just a kiss, I said, while I'm still alive to feel it. I smiled. I couldn't feel my lips, they were numb. But I could feel the muscles around them stretching just a little. I suppose it will be a sandy one, but I'll pretend you've been playing on the beach, making castles. All right, Daddy. She came closer, moving in a queer shambled drift that wasn't walking, and up close the illusion collapsed entirely. It was like bringing a painting close to your eyes and watching as the scene, portrait, landscape, still life, collapses into nothing but strokes of color, most with the marks of the brush still embedded in them. Ilsa's features disappeared. What I saw where they had been was nothing but a furious cyclone of sand and tiny bits of shell. What I smelled wasn't skin and hair, but only salt water. Pallid arms reached for me. Membranes of sand smoked off them in the wind. The moon shone through them. I held up the flashlight. It was short, and its barrel was plastic rather than stainless steel. You might want to look at this before you go giving away kisses, though, I said. It came from the glove compartment of Jack Cantori's car. The one with Percy inside is locked in Elizabeth's safe. The thing froze, and when it did, the wind off the gulf tore away the last semblance of humanity. In that moment, I was confronting nothing but a whirling sand devil. I took no chances, however. It had been a long day, and I had no intention of taking chances, especially if my daughter were somewhere. Well, somewhere else, and waiting for her final rest. I swung my arm as hard as I could, the flashlight clamped in my fist and Nan Melda's silver bracelet sliding down my arm to my wrist. I'd cleaned them carefully in the kitchen sink at El Palacio, and they jingled. I had one of the silver-tipped harpoons stuck in my belt behind my left hip for good measure, but I didn't need it. The sand devil exploded outward and upward. A scream of rage and pain went through my head. Thank God it was brief, or I think it would have torn me apart. Then there was nothing but the sound of the shells under Big Pink, and a brief dimming of the stars over the dunes to my right as the last of the sand blew away in a disorganized flurry. The gulf was once more empty, except for the moon-gilded rollers, marching in toward shore. The Percy had gone, if it had ever been there. The strength ran out of my legs and I sat down with a thump. Maybe I'd end up doing the crawly gator the rest of the way after all. If so, Big Pink wasn't far. Right now I thought I'd just sit here and listen to the shells. Rest a little. Then maybe I'd be able to get up and walk those last 20 yards or so. Go in and call Wireman. Tell him I was all right. Tell him it was done, that Jack could come and pick me up. But for now I would just sit here and listen to the shells, which no longer seemed to be talking in my voice or anyone else's. Now I would just sit here by myself on the sand and look out at the gulf and think about my daughter, Ilsa Marie Fremantle, who had weighed 6 pounds and 4 ounces at birth, whose first word had been dog, who had once brought home a large brown balloon crayoned on a piece of construction paper, shouting exultantly, "I drawed a picture of you, Daddy." Ilsa Marie Fremantle. I remember her well. 22. June. 1. I piloted the skiff out to the middle of Lake Phelan and killed the motor. We drifted toward the little orange marker I'd left there. A few pleasure boats buzzed back and forth on the glass-smooth surface, but no sailboats. The day was perfectly still. There were a few kids in the playground area, a few people in the picnic area, and a few on the nearest hiking trail skirting the water. On the whole, though, for a lake that's actually within the city limits, the area was almost empty. Wireman, looking strangely un-Florida, in a fisherman's hat and a Viking's pullover, commented on this. "School's still in," I said. "Give it another couple of weeks and there'll be boats buzzing everywhere." He looked uneasy. "Does that make this the right place for her, muchacho? I mean, if a fisherman should net her up." "No nets allowed on Lake Phelan," I said. "And there are few rods and reels. This lake is pretty much for pleasure boaters and swimmers in close to shore." I bent and picked up the cylinder the Sarasota silversmith had made. It was 3 feet long with a screw-down top at one end. It was filled with fresh water, and the water-filled flashlight was inside that. Percy was sealed in double darkness and sleeping in a double blanket of fresh water. Soon she would be sleeping even deeper. "This is a beautiful thing," I said. "That it is," Wireman agreed, watching the afternoon sun flash from the cylinder as I turned it over in my hand. "And nothing on it to catch a hook. Although I'd still feel easier about dumping it in a lake up around the Canadian border." "Where someone might really come along dragging a net," I said. "Hide in plain sight. It's not a bad policy." 3 young women in a sportabout went buzzing by. They waved. We waved back. One of them yelled, "We love cute guys!" And all 3 of them laughed. Wireman tipped them a smiling salute, then turned back to me. "How deep is it out here? Do you know? That little orange flag suggests you do." "Well, I'll tell you. I did a little research on Lake Phelan, probably overdue, since Pam and I have owned the place on Astor Lane going on 25 years. The average depth is 91 feet, except out here, where there's a fissure." Wireman relaxed and pushed his cap back a little from his brow. "Edgar, Wireman thinks you're still El Zorro, still the fox. Maybe see, maybe no. But there's 380 feet of water under that little orange flag. 380 at least. A hell of a lot better than a 12-foot cistern thumbed into a coral splinter on the edge of the Gulf of Mexico. Amen. You look well, Wireman. Rested." He shrugged. "That Gulf Stream's the way to fly. No standing in line at security, no pawing through your carry-on to make sure you didn't turn your little shit-ass can of foamy into a bomb. And for once in my life, I managed to fly north without a stop at fucking Atlanta. Thanks. Although I could have afforded it myself, it looks like. You settled with Elizabeth's relatives, I take it?" "Yep. Took your suggestion. Offered them the house and the north end of the key in exchange for the cash and securities. They thought that was a hell of a deal. And I could see their lawyers thinking, Wireman is a lawyer, and today he has a fool for a client. Guess I ain't the only Zorro in this boat. I'll end up with over $80 million in liquid assets, plus various keepsakes from the house, including Miss Eastlake's sweet Owen cookie tin. Think she was trying to tell me something with that, Chacho?" I thought of Elizabeth, popping various china figures into the tin and then insisting Wireman throw it in the goldfish pond. Of course she'd been trying to tell him something. The Rells got the north end of Duma Key. Development value, well, sky's the limit. 90 million? Or so they think. Yes, he agreed, turning somber. So they think. We sat in silence for a little while. He took the cylinder from me. I could see my face in its side, but distorted by the curve. I didn't mind looking at it that way, but I very rarely look at myself in a mirror anymore. It's not that I've aged. I don't care for the Fremantle fellow's eyes these days. They have seen too much. How's your wife and daughter? Pam's out in California with her mother. Melinda's back in France. She stayed with Pam for a while after Illy's funeral, but then she went back. I think it was the right call. She's getting on with it. What about you, Edgar? Are you getting on with it? I don't know. Didn't Scott Fitzgerald say there were no second acts in American life? Yep, but he was a washed-up drunk when he said it. Wireman put the cylinder at his feet and leaned forward. Listen to me, Edgar, and listen good. There are actually 5 acts, and not just in American lives, in every life that's fully lived. Same as in every Shakespearean play, tragedy and comedy alike. Because that's what our lives are made up of, comedy and tragedy. For me, the yucks have been in short supply just lately, I said. Yeah, he agreed, but Act 3 has potential. I'm in Mexico now, told you, right? Beautiful little mountain town called Tamazunchale. I gave it a try. Do you like the way it rolls off your tongue, Wireman can see that you do. I smiled. It do have a certain ring to it. There's this run-down hotel for sale there, and I'm thinking about buying it. It'd take 3 years of losses to put that kind of operation on a paying basis, but I've got a fat money belt these days. I could use a partner who knows something about building and maintenance, though. Of course, if you're still concentrating on matters artistic. I think you know better. Then what do you say? Let's marry our fortunes together. Simon and Garfunkel, 1969, I said, or thereabouts. I don't know, Wireman. I can't decide now. I do have one more picture to paint. Indeed you do. Just how big is this storm going to be? Dunno. But Channel 6 is gonna love it. Plenty of warning, though, right? Property damage is fine, but no one gets killed. No one gets killed, I agreed, hoping this would be true. But once that phantom limb was given free rein, all bets were off. That's why my second career had to end. But there would be this one final picture. Because I meant to be fully avenged. And not just for Illy, for Percy's other victims as well. Do you hear from Jack? Wireman asked. Just about every week. He's going to FSU in Tallahassee in the fall. My treat. In the meantime, he and his mom are moving down the coast to Port Charlotte. Was that also your treat? Actually, yes. Since Jack's father died of Crohn's disease, he and his mother had had a bit of a tough skate. And your idea? Right again. So you think Port Charlotte's going to be far enough south to be safe? I think so. And north, what about Tampa? Rain showers at most. It's going to be a small storm. Small, but powerful. A tight little Alice. Like the one in 1927. Yes. We sat looking at each other and the girls cruised by again in their sportabout, laughing louder and waving more enthusiastically than before. Sweet bird of youth, flying on afternoon wine coolers. We saluted them. When they were gone, Wireman said, Miss Eastlake's surviving relatives are never going to have to worry about getting building permits for their new property, are they? I don't think so, no. He thought it over, then nodded. Good. Send the whole island to Davy Jones's locker. Works for me. He picked up the silver cylinder, turned his attention to the little orange flag over the fissure that splits the middle of Lake Phelan, then looked back at me. Want to say any final words, muchacho? Yes, I said, but not many. Get 'em ready, then. Wireman turned on his knees and held the silver cylinder out. The sun sparkled on it for what I hoped would be the final time in at least 1,000 years. But I had an idea Percy was good at finding her way to the surface. That she had done it before, and would again. Even from Minnesota, she would somehow find the Caldo. I said the words I'd been holding in my mind. Sleep forever. Wireman's fingers opened. There was a small splash. We leaned over the side of the boat and watched the silver cylinder slide smoothly out of sight with one final glimmer of sunlight to mark its descent. 2. Wireman stayed that night and the next. We ate rare steaks, drank green tea in the afternoon, and talked about anything but old times. Then I took him to the airport, where he'd fly to Houston. There he planned to rent a car and drive south, see some of the country, he said. I offered to go with him as far as security, and he shook his head. You shouldn't have to watch as Wireman removes his shoes for a business school graduate, he said. This is where we say adios, Edgar. Wireman, I said, and could say no more. My throat was filled with tears. He pulled me into his arms and kissed me firmly on both cheeks. Listen, Edgar, it's time for Act 3, do you understand me? Yes, I said. Come down to Mexico when you're ready, and if you want to. I'll think about it. You do that. Con Dios, mi amigo, siempre con Dios. And you, Wireman, and you. I watched him walk away with his tote bag slung over one shoulder. I had a sudden brilliant memory of his voice the night Emery had attacked me in Big Pink, of Wireman shouting, Cojudo de puta madre, just before driving the candlestick into the dead thing's face. He had been magnificent. I willed him to turn back one final time, and he did. Must have caught a thought, my mother would have said, or had an intuition. That's what Nan Melda would have said. He saw me still standing there and his face lit in a grin. Do the day, Edgar, he cried. People turned to look, startled. And let the day do you, I called back. He saluted me, laughing, then walked into the jetway. And of course I did eventually come south to his little town. But although he's always alive for me in his sayings, I never think of them in anything but the present tense. I never saw the man himself again. He died of a heart attack 2 months later in Tamazunchale's open-air market while dickering for fresh tomatoes. I thought there would be time, but we always think stuff like that, don't we? We fool ourselves so much we could do it for a living. 3. Back at the place on Astor Lane, my easel stood in the living room where the light was good. The canvas on it was covered with a piece of toweling. Beside it, on the table with my oil paints, were several aerial photos of Duma Key, but I'd hardly glanced at them. I saw Duma in my dreams, and still do. I tossed the towel on the couch. In the foreground of my painting, my last painting, stood Big Pink, rendered so realistically I could almost hear the shells grating beneath it with each incoming wave. Propped against one of the pilings, the perfect surreal touch, were two red-headed dolls sitting side by side. On the left was Reba. On the right was Fancy, the one Cayman had fetched from Minnesota, the one that had been Illy's idea. The gulf, usually so blue during my time on Duma Key, I had painted a dull and ominous green. Overhead, the sky was filled with black clouds. They massed to the top of the canvas and out of sight. My right arm began to itch, and that remembered sensation of power began to flow first into me and then through me. I could see my picture almost with the eye of a god, or a goddess. I could give this up, but it would not be easy. When I made pictures, I fell in love with the world. When I made pictures, I felt whole. I painted a while, then put the brush aside. I mixed brown and yellow together with the ball of my thumb, then skimmed it over the painted beach, oh so lightly, and a haze of sand lifted, as if on the first hesitant puff of air. On Duma Key, beneath the black sky of an in-riding June storm, a wind began to rise. How to Draw a Picture. 12. Know when you're finished. And when you are, put your pencil or your paintbrush down. All the rest is only life. February 2006, June 2007.